Good afternoon. This is Evelyn Pringle. Welcome to Focus on the Facts. My guests today are Dr. Amy Reed and her husband, Dr. Hooman Norshazen, who have launched a campaign to ban power morcellators. Morcellation is a procedure used during hysterectomies where a medical device minces up fibroids in the uterus. But if the woman has undetected sarcoma, an aggressive cancer, morcellation spreads the sarcoma in the woman's belly and it eventually spreads throughout the body. For more than two decades, this procedure has been killing thousands of women every year in the U.S. and more across the world. An FDA study revealed that 1 in 350 women who have hysterectomies for fibroid removal actually have sarcoma, which means that every day, 2 to 5 women had a deadly cancer spread because of morcellation in the U.S. And yet not a single gynecologist, hospital, or device maker has ever reported this adverse reaction to the FDA, which is required by law. Amy and her husband, Hooman, were the first to report this to the FDA after Amy became a victim when gynecologists at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston used morcellation during her hysterectomy in October 2013. Hooman was the heart surgeon at Brigham at the time of Amy's surgery, and he started an online petition and sent out dozens of letters to the media and medical journals charging that using morcellation for hysterectomies was creating a public health crisis. They learned that Brigham's administration and their Department of Obstetrics and Gynecology had a clear understanding of the deadly hazard of morcellation by 2011. In the last 2 years, they've challenged the FDA, the gynecology profession, hospitals, and the device makers. They've garnered over 90,500 signatures on a petition to President Obama, the Senate and House of Representatives, and gynecology groups and other agencies. To date, as a result of their campaign, the FDA has issued a black box warning against the procedure. Many insurance companies are refusing to pay for morcellation. Hospitals have reduced or stopped using the procedure. And the Government Accountability Office and the FDA have launched investigations on the FDA, hospitals across the U.S., and device makers, basically to find out what they knew and for how long. This couple has 6 young children. Amy has been getting treatment for her cancer, but they continue to carry out this campaign to ban morcellation to save the lives of all the other women who may be subjected to this procedure if it remains on the market. As an investigative journalist, I've covered many of these kinds of campaigns against bad drugs or devices approved by the FDA for more than a dozen years. When people go up against Big Pharma like they're doing, they also have to fight against all the other players that Big Pharma has in their pocket. That includes the FDA, the gynecologists, and the hospitals making money off this device and their front groups. Today, I want Amy and Hooman to discuss their situation fully, but I also want them to discuss the kinds of bullying they've been put through from these people. I've been investigating this morcellation issue for close to 2 months now, and I have never seen such cold and heartless behavior before. I want to bring them on now. I'm so happy to have them on. Amy and Hooman, are you there?
Hello. Hello.
Hello. Welcome to the show. I'm so happy that you could come on, and I'm so happy that that you could come on too, Amy. I just learned a few minutes ago that you were going to be on here. I'm so happy that you could be here.
Oh, we're so glad, though. So, thank you so much for this opportunity.
Oh, I want to do this. I mean, like I said, I've been studying, you know, this campaign and this ban that we need on this morcellation, and I think of all the people that have been killed because of this and have been injured so badly, and that, you know, our regulatory watchdog has allowed this to continue, and the device makers, this isn't new to me. I've seen this happen with drugs and devices before, but that you people are waging such a powerful campaign and all the energy and things you're putting into it, it's just unbelievable to me. So I'm so happy to have you on the show. So maybe we can start
Thank you, Evelyn.
Telling a little bit about how this came about. You were even suspecting you were going to have morcellation, were you, Amy?
I'm sorry, Evelyn, you broke up a little bit. Could you repeat the question?
Oh, sure. I said, I'm not even sure. You weren't even sure you were going to have this morcellation when you went for your hysterectomy, were you?
No. So initially, when I had spoke with my the gynecologist, I had said that, you know, we have 6 children, and my stomach's been through quite a lot, and, you know, I know that whatever's easiest for the surgeon usually means it's better for the patient. So I said, really, I don't mind a big incision. I just, you know, want everything taken care of definitively. And I was told nobody does this like this anymore. You're young, you're healthy. That's not how they do these things. And so they led me down the path of a minimally invasive operation, which, you know, on the surface sounded great. You know, they go in through these small incisions, you know, you'll be back on your feet, you'll be home the same day. You know, our largest son was almost 11 pounds. So to me, I mean, this was going to be a breeze. The way they described it was going to be the cakewalk. I had every workup under the sun and, you know, saw top doctors in the field and they said, no, you don't have cancer. Don't be silly. You know, we're just talking to you because we're just seeing you really as a courtesy. You don't need us cancer doctors. This is how we do it. So, more salation and the whole spreading of the cancer, that was all something that, you know, unfortunately I didn't learn until after it happened to me.
So they didn't discuss this at all before your surgery?
No.
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 That this could possibly happen.
Unfortunately.
Exactly.
No.
Okay, so then.
So unfortunately, you know, before this happened to us and before, you know, we kind of started our own, I don't know if you want to call it a campaign, but until we started looking into things, this wasn't something that people knew about. Doctors weren't routinely telling their patients that, hey, we're going to chop this up inside of you. Not only that, doctors weren't telling their patients, but gynecologists specifically weren't telling the world. So other surgeons didn't know that gynecologists were doing this. They're kind of separated in their presentation of cases and whatnot in the hospital. So not only did the patients like me not know what was going to happen, but other doctors didn't know that they had continued this dangerous technique.
Okay. So when you went to them, explain how it happened when you went to them. How soon was your cancer diagnosed after the surgery?
It was the following week. So I had my surgery on a Thursday, and the following Friday morning I got a call from my gynecologist who had done the surgery. And she said, you know, your pathology came back. I'm sorry, you have leiomyosarcoma.
Evelyn, if I could add here. So, you know, Amy had some pretty serious symptoms for you know, a good 6 or 7 months. You know, her hemoglobin had dropped down to a pretty low level. She had a presumed fibroid that was very large and it wasn't regressing. And you know, I personally was concerned. So I sought out a gynecological oncologist, partly because, you know, my own mother had had a form of uterine cancer in her 40s. And so, you know, I was just concerned sort of viscerally because it just didn't seem like it was right. So we referred Amy to a gynecological oncologist, and, you know, he's quite a decorated gynecological oncologist at the Brigham and Women's Hospital. And, you know, he evaluated her very, very carefully. You know, she had 2 ultrasounds, an MRI, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, he basically came to the conclusion that this is he wrote in his office report that, you know, this is clearly a benign process. And he went ahead, reassured her, and sent her to a, you know, minimally invasive gynecologist. And, you know, we're both in the system, so we tend to trust our colleagues, especially at a place like the Brigham. And so, you know, it sort of morphed from there. And it wasn't until a week after her operation that her diagnosis came back. And you know, you've read in the press that, you know, my first response to this was, you know, I know you didn't do an oncological operation, a cancer operation, that is, but did you at least get this out in one piece? And that's when, you know, the whole concept of morcellation came up. And, you know, as a general and thoracic surgeon, I was just completely astonished by the fact that these folks would even consider morcellating a tumor that has malignant potential inside the body. And then from there, we realized that, you know, they were getting the numbers all wrong and they weren't even informing patients about it. I mean, it was a colossal systemic act of negligence and a really bad error in women's health, frankly.
Right. Yeah, that's very scary, and it's really scary, too, because they do this morcellation, but it sounds like they really did do a lot of testing and stuff on Amy, so they should have found it if it was there. You know, if they do all that amount of testing,
yeah, I mean,
you know, you'd think that they would find it.
The problem with this specific cancer is, you know, there's no good way to figure out whether or not a woman has it before she actually has the surgery. This cancer looks very much like fibroids, which, as you know, are very common. It's estimated, 8 out of 10 women have fibroids throughout their lifetime. But this particular cancer isn't something that shows up any differently than fibroids by MRI. There's no tests you can do. You can do a biopsy, but the layer of the uterus that this grows from isn't the layer they biopsy. So it's like testing someone for brain cancer by biopsying the scalp. Like, it's you're missing all of these women with cancer. I had MRIs, I had ultrasounds, I had biopsies, and everything came back completely normal. I was reassured again and again by top physicians in the field that this was completely normal fibroid behavior.
Right, and this is what's so scary, that they go ahead and do this when like you said, that they gave you all these tests and everything that they thought they could assure you that it wasn't, and then they just go in there and do this morcellation anyhow.
Yeah, I think obviously what's most scary is that, we went to them and said, something has changed, something's wrong. There was this feeling, and we let our guard down. We trusted our colleagues.
Yeah.
Evelyn, what's really critical about this to understand is, I think that essentially an assumption was being made by an entire specialty, gynecology in particular, right, that uterine fibroids are benign, okay? Now I want you to sort of step back and think about, breast masses, which also are very common, right? Breast surgeons confronted with a breast mass will never assume that the breast mass is benign. They assume that it's, potentially malignant until proven otherwise, because the fear is that the women who would have breast masses that are cancerous would be missed. And in fact, if you look at the incidence of breast masses, the most common breast mass is a fibroadenoma, which is benign. But, somewhere around, 1 out of 300 to 500 breast masses turn out to be malignant as well. So the assumption of benignity with respect to fibroids is something that was unique to gynecologists. And this is a very severe error because, this is probably one of the most common operations in the United States and across the world, a hysterectomy and a myomectomy, which is the removal of the fibroids. And to assume that these tumors are benign, is essentially inviting, a minority subset of women whose fibroids actually do contain cancer to be at risk of upstaging their cancer using a device called the power morcellator. This power morcellator essentially is nothing but a meat grinder. I mean, you're welcome to do a search on Google and you'll see exactly what it is. It's a meat grinder that grinds up the tissue and sucks it out.
Yeah, I posted all a bunch of articles and videos and stuff on my timeline, on my Facebook timeline, so that people listening want to go on there and look at some of this. And yes, I'm sure I posted the one that has the morcellator in it and shows what it does. So, I mean, you picture this, from inside the stomach or uterus, and you see this, and it's like, oh, my God, to do that, to tear that apart like that, spread it around, it's just, it's unbelievable.
I mean, looking at it from the outside, almost everyone has that response. Like, what a sloppy tool. Like, of course that's going to spread cancer. But, for whatever, there are a number of reasons, that we've talked about before, but gynecologists have trained with this instrument and never questioned it. I mean, year after year, these were being done, hundreds of thousands of these have been done, and no one stopped and said, these probably aren't a very good tool to use. They were easy, they were quick, women were back on their feet with small incisions, and if you had cancer, well, then I'm sorry, you came to me with it, I didn't give it to you. I mean, I made it worse, but no one said those words. No one followed up with that statement.
Right, and in my investigation, I did find papers and I did find articles and stuff where they've known this for years,
right.
And they had discussions about it and everything. And some of them brought this up. Maybe it isn't a good idea to be using these.
Absolutely. There have been publication, and in fact, without question, out of the institute where I had my surgery done, oncologists have been asking this for years, having meetings about it, because they're the ones who ultimately receive the patients. They've been talking about it, but within the gynecological community, really, there's been very little discussion of it.
Yeah, Evelyn, that's actually one of the most striking things about this, is that, as early as 2005, 2006, There have been reports in the literature, and as early as 2011, there was actually a discussion at a gynecological oncology forum about this. And so there was awareness in the field, and certainly from the perspective of many other surgeons who look at this. I mean, this is just an incorrect practice. I mean, you know, no other surgeons other than gynecologists have this habit of taking a tumor inside someone's body and chopping it up into pieces. So, you know, the data was out there, and in fact, you know, we relatively rapidly after we reviewed the literature, after this complication happened to Amy, well, we were able to, with the help of one of our colleagues at Boston University, we were able to decipher the number initially to be 1 out of 415 women, which was very different than the 1 in 10,000 number that the gynecologists were, you know, suggesting. And in fact, at the rate of 1 in 10,000, they weren't even bothering to inform the women of this risk. The majority of gynecologists were not talking about this. They sort of viewed it as a minor technical detail that the patient doesn't need to know about. Now, I'm going to step back and tell you that we don't believe that bad medicine is justified by informed consent. This is bad medicine. This is a bad surgical practice. It's an incorrect surgical practice. And even if they had informed their patients, it still wouldn't do anything to protect them from this this danger. So informed consent is not really the solution to bad medicine. And this is, frankly, bad medicine because it sacrifices, it causes a collateral damage that's completely avoidable.
Right, right. And I would picture doctors, you know, I'm picturing how doctors talk then, that if they found cancer and things, like you two knew, you know so much about medicine, and you knew questions to ask. So, but I can picture them if they found cancer, not even mentioning that they did this morcellation, just saying that when they, you know, they did the hysterectomy and they took the stuff out, that there was cancer.
Evelyn, you know, for two decades, gynecologists...
Right.
have been using this tool, spreading cancer, and when women's pathology comes back, they say, I'm sorry, you have cancer. And women
right.
have been saying, well, what's next? And they say, I don't know. That happens. Yeah, they would send you off then to an oncologist. And the woman that leaves their office, when I left my gynecologist's office, you know, I looked great. I was young, fit, I had all my hair. You know, so it was never a second thought. You know, they don't see what happens 2 years later. They don't see the chemos and the surgeries and everything, a lot of which has to be done just to correct the morcellation. So the bits you spread
exactly.
out all over just to have that reversed. I was in the hospital for 12 days. I had a blood clot in my lungs. I missed Thanksgiving with my children just simply to take care of what the morcellation had done, cancer aside.
Right. Right.
So,
this is what
yes,
I'm saying. After
decades,
the surgery,
women...
they don't tell these women the procedure I use now is going to make that cancer go from stage 1 to stage 4.
Nope.
You know,
no.
due to the procedure. Like you said, they told you had cancer. That's not basically their fault. But
yep.
if it would
have
taken
out
in
whole. And you know, Evelyn, you know, and it's precisely that delayed process that I think let this go on for as long as it did. If patients were dying on the table, on the operating room table, by the gynecologist's
right.
hands, it would be very different because they would feel that viscerally. When something bad happens to the patient in front of you, I mean, that's an
yeah.
awful feeling. You know, I'm a physician. I know what it's like to have patients put their trust in you and to have things happen. I have no question that if that were happening, if we were dying right in front of these gynecologists, that someone would have raised this red flag sooner. But the fact of the matter is, we were the first ones to report this problem to the FDA, and this morcellator and versions of it has been on the market for 20 years.
Right, right. And I know that there's a report out there, too, by that doctor that he told Johnson & Johnson back in 2006 that their device was doing this.
Absolutely, absolutely.
And they
so
just blew
so
him
why
off.
Was that never reported?
Because Johnson & Johnson wanted to keep selling this product, and they don't care who lives or dies, these drug companies. As long as they can make money, they don't care. I followed these kind of campaigns for 12, 13 years, and it's always the same.
Evelyn,
all they care about.
Evelyn, you know, I don't think anyone is out to hurt anyone, but I think people really were buying that. They were, you know, thinking, you're right, you had cancer, I didn't give you cancer, and then turning a blind eye.
Twisting
you know, whether it's
truth,
business, whether it's money, you are absolutely right. They were notified of a problem, a very serious problem, and it stopped there. And then...
Right.
10 years later, I'm laying on the operating room table with the same device being used to spread my cancer.
Right, and wasn't a woman hurt like this just several months before your surgery?
Can I answer that, Evelyn?
Yeah.
So, Evelyn, just before we answer that question about the other patient who had been harmed at the Brigham, here's the point. You know, you mentioned something about these drug companies, you know, hurting people, et cetera. This is absolutely correct. And the reason, however, is that I think the majority of folks who are in the healthcare industry sort of have this slogan of they're trying to help people and bring life-saving care and devices, et cetera, to people. The problem is twofold. One is that when money starts to lubricate the process, people tend to get complacent. When you're making a lot of money off of something, people get complacent. And number two when the ethical framework for what exactly it is and how we ought to be thinking about side effects and adverse events ends up falling apart and being compromised because money is being made, that's when the problem comes in. So, look, you know, we don't necessarily ascribe to this concept that there are these evil people sitting there and, you know, consciously wanting to hurt people. But we do ascribe to the concept that when there's a lot of money being made, people get punch drunk, number one. And when folks in healthcare especially don't start thinking about the ethics of harm, the ethics of what it means to harm people avoidably or to put people in harm's way, and they let, you know, corporate objectives, which is essentially to make money, override ethics, that's when problems come in. And I think a lot of what we've experienced has had to do with the fact that, you know, this practice was a very large practice. A lot of money was being made from it. A massive level of infrastructure was devoted to it. And so folks, had a hard time giving it up. And frankly, it was essentially, you know, also sort of protected by this level of professional ego, which goes into being a physician. I mean, you know, I think I can confidently say, as a physician myself, that sometimes being a doctor gets to your head, you know?
Sure. And, well, I'll tell you, I want to say, when you first went to them and complained, how nonchalant was Brigham and Young with you then? Brigham and Women's with you then?
I'll set the scene for you. I was just newly out of the hospital. The surgery that I had left about a 12-inch incision running down the front of my abdomen. I was pretty weak. I really couldn't walk for very long distances or stand up straight, really, even. And, you know, both my husband and I have MDs and PhDs from the University of Pennsylvania, and we were part of the system. So my expectation is that we were going to have a meeting, and we were going to lay out exactly what had happened and that they would immediately see this. You know, this is a hospital that flies banners of we are first in patient safety, you know, all over the hospital, that they would see that this was an issue and say, of course, you know, we are going to put a stop to this until this is sorted out. Because remember, Evelyn, most of these surgeries are elective. If there's a question as to whether or not it's safe, these women can wait. I mean, it's not comfortable. I was uncomfortable. My hemoglobin was low. Right. But I could have waited a year if there was a question about the safety of the tool that they were going to use. I expected them to say, we're going to wait. We are going to stop using these tools, just like if an operating room table had been hurting patients or electric cautery equipment. If another device had been hurting patients that they didn't have to use, it's automatically flagged. It's pulled out of their hands. So when we walked up to that meeting, I was absolutely shocked that they were like, I'm sorry, this isn't up for discussion. Morphylation isn't up for discussion. And basically told my husband, you should consider taking some time to be with your family.
Oh, man. Yeah, because he was working there at the time, eh?
Yeah, Evelyn, I was a cardiothoracic surgeon who had just finished my training at the Brigham, and they had hired me as an assistant professor at Harvard Medical School and as a cardiothoracic surgeon at the Brigham. So I think one thing is really notable in what Amy said here, right? Which is that, you know, number one, not only did they not respond appropriately to our concerns, I mean, not only did they give us pushback and try to basically get me to stop, you know, communicating about this stuff with everyone. But they also, later on, we found out that there was another woman at the Brigham and Women's Hospital who, a year prior to Amy's operation, had been harmed in the same way. And when Amy had her operation, she was actually laying on her deathbed at the Brigham and Women's Hospital. Now, she was operated on by the chief of minimally invasive gynecology at the Brigham and Women's Hospital, a gentleman by the name of Dr. John Einerman. He had operated on her. He had spread her cancer. He was the chief of the division. He knew. They had had meetings about this lady. They had had high-level meetings about this lady and never bothered to call this a sentinel event. But even more egregiously, when you actually look
I read that, you know, when you wrote that. What does a sentinel event mean? I don't understand. What does that mean?
A sentinel event means that if something really bad happens to someone because of, say, a device or a drug or a practice, the entire hospital safety infrastructure has to be activated to call it a safety breach and to eliminate it from use. So in other words, if I'm in the operating room, Evelyn, and say I use a cautery pad and someone develops a burn, right, because of some sort of a defect in this cautery pad, this grounding pad, we immediately pull those off the shelf. Or if I use a stapler to staple tissue when I'm operating and the stapler misfires, for instance, or it breaks, say, during operation, we immediately pull that off the shelf and we take evasive action to make sure it doesn't happen again. Now, this other lady had been harmed. She was on her deathbed from a cancer that was eroding through one of her incisions, all right? And the Brigham and Women's Hospital CMO, the chief of minimally invasive gynecology at the Brigham and Women's Hospital, and the chief of general gynecology had not bothered to stop doing this. And when we brought it up, their response was, look, this is just a matter of your opinion. This benefits a vast majority of women.
Yeah. So, the heck with Amy, huh? Or the other one.
I was just unlucky.
Yeah. Yeah. And, yeah, and that's why I want to get into this bullying business, because I don't know why I use that word. That's the term people use nowadays. But, you know, I've been investigating these kind of campaigns, and I know when you go up against a bad drug or a bad device, you're going to be fighting the FDA, you're going to be fighting the doctors, you're going to be fighting all of them that, you know, are making money off this in the FDA and farmer's pocket, that's not a campaign against one drug company, like, say, the drug company that you had. They even came out and said that it threatened to sue Hooman, didn't they? Because he was defaming their device.
Bullying is absolutely the right word, Evelyn. I would not have, you know, I'm somebody who has been raised here my whole life. I have faith in the system. I had faith in my doctors. I had faith in medicine. I was one of them. I would have never believed it had I not seen it. When we received that letter from Carl Storrs threatening to sue my husband for defamation, I couldn't even believe that. I mean, again, my response is, you know, if I've made a mistake, let me know so I don't repeat that mistake. That was not at all the response we encountered. Now, my husband, with the tenacity that he has, he said, bring it. You know, bring it. If you really are coming after me for this issue, that is all the more publicity for this problem. And we'll bring it about, we'll bring it into it sooner. But absolutely, Evelyn, it has been bullying from the get-go.
Yes. And then, you were fortunate, you know, and I've heard Hooman talk on tapes and stuff about this, you know, to get the press involved actively in things like this. The average person like me or something, you know, wouldn't be able to do this. But you have enough knowledge and enough background and you know, important in the system and in the medical profession to be able to do this. And I think the Wall Street Journal reported, and I think they even were up for a Pulitzer Prize, weren't they? Finalists for a Pulitzer Prize on that article they wrote?
That's right, Evelyn. So the Wall Street Journal, Jennifer Levitz and John Camp did become Pulitzer finalists. Also, the Cancer Letter, I think, ended up winning a National Press Club Award, which, you know, both the Cancer Letter and the Wall Street Journal really concomitantly, you know, worked the details of the story out and you know, really did, I think, did a fantastic job on all fronts. But look, you know, I'm just going to step back, if you don't mind, about this whole bullying thing, right? So I think that the tendency of the system currently is for the boat not to be rocked, okay? So if you're someone who's going to rock the boat, you must be some sort of an anarchist, or there must be something wrong with you, or you must not be thinking straight because, you know, everything is so perfect, right? I mean, that's sort of the tendency for the folks who are in charge of our establishment to think that, you know, how could there be anything possibly that wrong, right? So there must be something wrong with the guy who's standing in the corner sort of complaining or making a ruckus, right? So I think that basically what it comes down to is that this bullying behavior has to do with the fact that the people in charge of the establishment aren't really willing to be self-critical, you know? And again, I think this is because money makes people punch drunk, you know? Money and power makes people punch drunk. And so unless you actually have a very sort of, you know, disciplined way to question your ethical framework and what you're doing, you know, and to listen carefully to people who are claiming that they were hurt, unless you have that, you know, you will use your power to do wrong things. So, yes, the company Carl Storz, which built the device that harmed my wife, did threaten to sue me for defamation instead of listening carefully to what we were saying, because what we were talking about was both scientific and ethical. The Brigham and Women's Hospital did the same thing. They instead of listening carefully, instead of hearing what I have to say as one of their own surgeons, as someone who has spent 20 years in the medical system, as someone who has two doctorates, an MD and a PhD, instead of listening to that, Evelyn, what they chose to do, okay, was to sort of paint me as this picture who was personally compromised. And I think we do that to a lot of folks who are hurt, you know, and I think we have to stop doing that to people who are hurt, you know. I think eventually our system is not going to be fixed, and we're going to continue to see harm and loss to the system unless we can sit back and be self-critical, you know, because, you know, what we do is far from perfect.
Well, yeah, you know, in any profession, any job, their mistakes are going to be made, you know, but like you said, own up to them when they're made, you know, deal with them and get rid of them like this. Now, why they wouldn't ban this procedure right off the bat and say, well, temporarily even, to say, yes, we need to stop this right now. We're not going to do anymore. You know, we're going to, you know, investigate this thoroughly.
Well, you know, so the first response that we got, Evelyn, was that they're going to start informing patients, okay? And so we immediately objected to that. And you know, again, I'm going to reiterate this. You know, informed consent is a medical legal device that protects doctors and hospitals, okay? Because if a patient gets harmed, okay, let's say you're a woman and you have a cancer that's not known, that's occult, okay? And, you know, you agree that you would undergo a morcellation and your doctor doesn't think that you have cancer and they offer you a morcellation, right? And let's say you walk into that operating room and you have a cancer and it's morcellated and it spreads all over, right? Even though you gave informed consent and you agreed to it, that doesn't do anything to protect you. It does everything to protect the hospital and the doctor, you know?
Right.
But even then, it doesn't really protect the hospital and the doctor because it's sort of careless, you know what I mean?
Right. And at that point, even if they wrote up that informed consent and showed you and said, we're going to tell every woman this and stuff, they wouldn't have had the right numbers that came out as a result of your campaign and getting the FDA involved and making them look at this and getting...
You know, Evelyn, the sad fact is that the Brigham and Women's Hospital actually would have had the right numbers because they published it. You know, they had published it a year before Amy's operation, you know. And, in fact, they were in possession of this knowledge for at least 2 or 3 years, you know. And furthermore, what's fantastically amazing to me is that the chief of minimally invasive gynecology, this gentleman, Dr. Einerson, he had been attempting to create devices that would contain the morcellated bits. You see what I mean? And so that means that he had knowledge that this is a problem. Well, you know, then the question is, well, if you have knowledge of some danger, why would you expose patients to it? And the answer to that is not that he's evil. He's not evil. He's, you know, what's happening here is that there's a very large infrastructure devoted to the practice. A lot of money is being built off it. And they've convinced themselves that it benefits the majority of people. And, you know, let me tell you, I think that, yes, minimally invasive gynecology, minimally invasive surgery does benefit a vast majority of women. And yes, the vast majority of women, 99.5% of women, do not have cancers, okay, in their fibroids. But the 0.5% who do are a minority subset of people whose lives are in harm's way. And there's right. absolutely no justification in the year 2016, back then in the year 2013, in this country, for a minority subset of people to be allowed to fall through a crack because the majority benefit, or because it's convenient, or because the women have the right to choose, or because it's economically beneficial. Now, you know, I want to also step back and, you know, talk about this concept of choice. You know, these folks are framing the American College of Obstetrics and Gynecology and the people who are defending this practice are saying that in response to our campaign that one of the things we have done is we have taken choice away from women. Okay? Now, the right. issue is this, that they're using catchphrases that are completely inappropriate and misplaced. Because you see, mm-hmm. when we talk about, when we think about choice in this country, women's choice, we're talking about reproductive choice, okay? We're talking about things like birth control and access to safe abortions, right? We're not talking about, you know, the right to choose your fibroid tumor to be chopped up inside your body, you know? That's just bad medicine. And so it is an extreme misrepresentation. It's an extremely misguided and dangerous misrepresentation to use this catchphrase of choice to defend a practice that puts a minority subset of women in harm's way. That's just not a tenable ethical argument.
And didn't I read where you said gynecologists don't go through the same kind of training as other surgeons as far as operating procedures and things like that?
Well, yeah, I mean, that's
very common.
That's a well-known fact.
Yeah, I don't think most people know that.
Yeah, I mean, you know, Amy and I wrote about that in the Philadelphia Inquirer, but basically gynecological surgeons don't cross-train with other surgeons. They're very sort of siloed in their training. So they basically, you know, train with other gynecologists. You know, they maybe spend a couple of weeks in an ICU somewhere, maybe a month of a medicine rotation, but they never train with other surgeons. Because I can tell you that if a general surgeon or a thoracic surgeon or a neurosurgeon or an orthopedic surgeon would actually visualize what it is that they were doing to these tumors, the immediate question would become, well, is that safe? You know?
Right.
And you know, the fact is that this is also, the reason for this is that gynecologists don't really cross-train with other surgeons. And I think that's a very serious defect in our medical education system. In terms of residency training, that 50% of the population, that is women, okay, are going to doctors, many of them using these doctors as their primary care physicians, you know? And these doctors have not sufficiently cross-trained. They haven't cross-trained. They don't have enough of a liberal education to understand certain concepts, like you don't mince up a tumor inside someone's body when you're taking it out.
Right. Right. Now, when you went to the FDA, how did they act? Initially, I know that you did hook up with somebody that was pretty agreeable with your, you know, listened and things. Was that Dr. Lori?
Yeah. So I can tell you the story of Dr. Lori. I'm just going to interject here. Amy had to leave, and she'll be back in a little bit. So it's just me right now on the line here.
Okay.
So initially, when all this happened and we realized that there's a problem, I approached my colleague who's a Master of Public Health at BU, Dr. Pasha Orlo. We went to medical school together. And Dr. Pasha, and you know, I noticed that the incidence numbers that they were quoting for people were inconsistent with the literature, because the literature looked to me more like 1 in 500, not 1 in 10,000. And, you know, I took it to Dr. Pasha Orlo, and he concluded that, in fact, the gynecologists are using the incorrect denominator to calculate the risk. So, you know, the risk of 1 in 10,000 is in the risk to the general population of having a uterine leiomyosarcoma. So 1 in 10,000 women in this country will have a uterine leiomyosarcoma. But when you're talking about women who walk into the gynecologist's office with symptomatic fibroids, okay, these women have an incidence closer to 1 in 3 to 400, okay? Simply because, you know, they're walking into the doctor's office with the symptoms of, you know, bleeding, pelvic pain, large masses, et cetera. So, you know, that number was very clear to us, you know, and the first thing that I did was I shared this with Dr. Peter Lori. Now, Peter Lori is a patient advocate, comes from a patient advocacy background at publiccitizen.org.
Yeah, that's where I remembered him from.
Yeah. So he worked with Sid Wolf, and he, you know, he is, you know, he's a patient advocate. That's his background. And he, you know, he had been hired as the associate commissioner of the FDA and the Office of Policy and Planning. And the first thing that I did was I shot an email to him with the results of this. And literally, I don't think it even took an hour. He shot back an email. I don't know Dr. Lori. He just shot back an email. He understood the magnitude of it. And he said, has this data been published yet? Now, we had, Michael Pasha Orlo had submitted this paper to the New England Journal of Medicine. And the New England Journal of Medicine ultimately rejected this paper, even though, you know, the study was pretty solidly done by him
really?
And several other members. But, you know, essentially Dr. Lori listened to us. And I think that was a massive sort of win for us because we had an associate commissioner of the FDA listening, and I think he triggered an investigation that led to a hearing in July of 2014.
Great. And it was at that hearing that they did issue a warning, right?
Well,
they didn't issue
the black
label till November.
Well, at that hearing, what ended up happening was that there was a massive defense of morcellation mounted by industry advocates. So people came from Ethicon, which was Johnson & Johnson. They came from the American College of Obstetrics and Gynecology, the American Association of Gynecological Laparoscopists, the Society of Gynecological Oncologists. All these folks had come there to essentially defend the practice of morcellation, not to...
This is what they do in these campaigns. This is what they do.
Right.
You know,
so they were defending their
again.
Financial interests, you know?
Sure. Sure. And then
after you came
forward with this story, didn't a bunch of people come out? Didn't people contact you and, you know, after it hit the newspapers, the big story, didn't a bunch of people...
Yeah, Evelyn, one of the things that we had done is we had started the campaign on change.org. You know, when I realized that Dr. Ashley, who's the CMO of the Brigham and Women, wasn't going to use his Harvard position to make a change. Because, you know, my initial instinct, like Amy said, was that, you know, we're going to bring this problem to these Harvard professors and surgeons, and they're all going to see exactly
right.
what the problem is, and they're going to shut it down from Harvard, and from there it's going to trickle into everyone, right? But instead of doing that,
right.
he started pushing me back. And I frankly realized this when Amy was having her damage control operation to remove all these morcellated pieces. And I started a petition from her bedside at the Washington Hospital Center where Dr. Sugarbaker was operating on her to get rid of these morcellated pieces. And, you know, that's how it morphed. I mean, you know, really a lot of people started coming out on this change.org site. I mean, you're welcome to look at it. And, you know, right now we have about 90,000 people signing it. And there are literally hundreds of stories on that website.
You got 9,500 as of a few days ago. But yes.
Yeah, 90,500.
Right, there's wonderful stories on that website, on that petition. And then you keep adding some, too, that makes it so interesting to keep going back. And I'm going to post that petition on my website again, so on Facebook and on Face the Facts site.
Thank
and,
you.
Thanks. For people to sign.
Yeah, you know, immediately what struck us was, and what people said to us initially when we said, you know, the incidence of this sarcoma is not 1 in 10,000, which is the number we were told. But it's more around 1 in 400. We came up with 1 in 415 was our initial estimate, which matched what Dr. Lamparter had come up with 10 years ago, and the was subsequently reiterated by the FDA. You know, people said, well, if this is so common, how come people don't know about this? Why haven't I heard about this? And we were really struck, you know, after the change.org started getting some publicity, the number of women who came out of the woodwork, the stories, my mother, my sister, my aunt, myself, all these hundreds of women who no one had asked any questions. There were no unifying voices. Many of them had no idea about morcellation.
Right.
And,
exactly.
You know, even those that had, you know, had suffered from and those who had died from directly because it had been cut up in their abdomens, they didn't know.
Right. Right.
And the numbers were just, I mean, the numbers were heartbreaking.
Right. I know it. This whole situation is heartbreaking. And didn't a bunch of people go to the FDA meeting then?
It did. There were a number of women at the FDA, a number of family members, friends, affected people, people whose family members had been affected. But, you know, the problem with forums like the FDA, when you have people, particularly patients with cancer, arguing, you know, that devices aren't safe, and they're arguing against device manufacturers, are, you know, device manufacturers have lawyers and consultants
yep.
and administrators who all feel great, who all are paid to do their job and show up in Washington, D.C., versus people on chemo, status post-surgery, people who are nauseous, who are chronically in pain, asking to take trains and find childcare for their kids. And, you know, it is
right.
not a level playing field. So, we did have people there. We had met, you know, I was really impressed with the turnout that we had. But we will never have the numbers. You know, no patient group will ever have the numbers or the force, you know, compared to say Johnson and Johnson.
Right.
You know, it is
right.
very easy.
I've attended
for
some
our
of those hearings. I've attended and I've had, you know, where people came to testify and stuff about the harm done, and yeah, they're really given a short rope compared to, you know, the big pharma representatives and lawyers and things. You know, the one I went to, like the patients could testify, but they were given like 3 minutes or 2 minutes or something each. And stuff, and
mm-hmm.
and these people had heartbreaking stories to tell, but the FDA at that time would sit up there, and it was like they weren't even listening. You know, I'd watch
and
them.
For
and
me,
like,
for me, it was really difficult, the FDA, because I got up there and I presented, and the board, I think there were 13 members on the board, 9 of whom were OBGYNs. So 9 of
right.
whom had trained and used this tool, one of which
right.
had sat, one of which was working in the hospital system, which had done my surgery as well as this other woman, so knew about this.
Right.
I mean, these are people whose silence cost me years of my life, potentially. So,
yeah.
you know,
yeah.
I mean, how does one not come across as emotional? How does one not come across not as upset? When I'm trying to tell people who should clearly have recognized this problem, and I'm trying to plead them my case. I mean, there's a bioethicist on the board, and the bioethicist said, this is wrong. There's a general surgeon on the board, and the general surgeon said, I cannot say this, you know, this is a problem. I cannot say this should stay on the market. But the majority of the board is
right.
OBGYN.
Right. I was reading that, and you can tell the ones that aren't in the profession that benefits from this. I mean, they
yeah.
usually will speak out, but like you say, they're outnumbered because there's not that many of them. Well, they
right.
can't just speak up and demand it.
Right.
So,
well,
yeah, when
know,
I read about this and I see you going through this, the process is always the same. The tactics are the same. How they come at people that try to get rid of a bad drug or device or something. You know, this campaign on their side is always the same. And then,
yeah.
and then
well,
I
it,
want
it,
to talk
about...
Go ahead.
Sorry. Yeah, you know, you're right. It's, you know, the ultimate issue here is, and I think this speaks to sort of a deviation of the FDA and, frankly, our entire federal government, you know, both on the Democrat side and the Republican side, from this notion, from this concept that, look, you know, when people in this society, when the people in our country, which is a free market society, you know, when people get harmed, when something bad happens because of a transaction, doesn't matter if it's in healthcare, doesn't matter if it's in any other sector of the economy, right? When people get
right.
harmed, they usually go home, they go bankrupt, or they die, you know. And you know
right.
what the incredible thing is, you know, is that when that happens to people, their voice gets excluded from the democracy. And so, therefore, Congress can't get feedback. The federal agencies can't get feedback from these folks. And in fact, it is the role of the federal government to protect the rights, the lives, and the dignity of citizens of this country. And if a federal agency fails to do that, if a federal agency somehow believes that, you know, corporate America is an equal stakeholder to individual American citizens, then they've got it wrong.
Right.
And unfortunately, I think
yes,
over the
do.
Past 50 to 100 years, what's happened is, as the corporate lobby power has sort of gained a lot of muscle, our federal agencies and many of our congressional representatives, including some who are incredibly liberal, you know, and who pose themselves as Robin Hood, you know, these folks have sort of deviated from that mission, you know. And I can tell you,
right.
you know, what we're disappointed by, what we're incredibly disappointed by, was to find that Senator Al Franken from Minnesota is a serious
right.
and major advocate for the medical device industry. We also engaged Senator Elizabeth Warren in Massachusetts, who you know, I think she's a obviously a very nice lady, and you know, she clearly has as her political agenda the defense of the defenseless. You know, I mean, she is the liberal senator from Massachusetts. You know, and here right. she is in one of the states where the largest one of the largest medical device manufacturers in the country is. You know, Boston Scientific is up in Massachusetts, and you know, when we engaged Senator Warren, she initially, you know, really complimented us on this this fight that we're waging for women's health. But then the moment we started to criticize the FDA and the medical device industry's regulation, she completely disengaged from us. And,
sure.
you know, we found that terribly striking because here it is. It's like, you know, if anyone, it should be Senator Warren who will stand up next to us and say, look, you know, there's a real serious problem. She disengaged, you know. So I think it's a systemic problem, and it comes from the fact that, you know, corporate America really has an undue influence on convincing our federal
agencies and
our federal government. I'm sorry?
Congressman, I mean, they take so much money from Big Pharma that anybody that looks at this, very few people do go investigate it. They see how much money they're giving these people. There's no way in hell that they're going to stick up for us guys. There isn't. I mean, they're totally bought off. It's just awful. And that they're
lying to give all this money. That may be true, except that that's sort of the constitutional mandate of federal representatives,
yeah.
okay? Because fundamentally, I think what we ought to sort of really try to impress on folks is that the Constitution of this country was created to protect the lives, the rights, and the dignity of individual citizens, you know? And part of it was for government not to impinge too much, but you know, yes, part of it was to make sure that the folks aren't getting, you know, royally screwed. And so when the federal government deviates from that, when the federal agencies deviate from that, I think we could be seriously in trouble.
Oh, absolutely. I think we are seriously in trouble. You know, and I think this goes for agencies, you know, running other industries too. You know, these companies pour so much money into them that there's no way they can't be bought off. I mean, they accept it. I've tracked this for 13 years too. How much money and how much it's increased, giving all our congressmen and presidents and everything. And it's just unbelievable that they can get away with this, because this is what happens. This is what put this country in the shape it's in, that you can't get anything changed with them. So,
well, I think we will have a Trump presidency to look forward to a complete corporate takeover of the federal government.
I don't follow that charade whatsoever.
Again, I don't want to deviate too far, but I think
this circus they put up for 2 years before an election, I don't follow it ever. The electronic voting system is rigged, and both parties know about it, and they'll put in whoever they want to put in. So this charade and this circus every day with this happening, I don't follow one bit of it. I haven't listened to one speech or anything from any of them. They're all bought off, and I don't pay attention to any of them, because no matter who gets in, they're not going to change anything. But I wanted you to talk a little bit about the time that the hospital did to you when Amy had that surgery, had to have more surgery, and how I'll let you tell the story. They sent you a letter, right?
Me a letter. That, you know, look, the issue is this. I've generated somewhere close to 7,000 to 8,000 emails, and most of these emails are, I'm sorry?
Yeah, hello? Sure, that's good.
Yeah, so I've sent somewhere around 7,000 to 8,000. Most of these emails are very inflammatory. Most of them are calls to duty. Most of them are calls to responsibility. Most of them delineate exactly what our grievance is with people who are in positions of power at a medical school and a hospital like the Brigham and Women's Hospital and Harvard Medical School. And I think that these folks sitting on this very high ivory tower and this very influential perch, they felt really threatened by this, you know? And frankly, you know, instead of sort of looking around and saying, okay, well, you know what? Maybe he's right. Maybe we should say, look, you know, you're right. We need to fix this. Instead of that, they take this defensive posture, you know? And you know, it suddenly becomes an issue of, you know, feeling that their security is threatened even, you know? Now, meanwhile, here I am, right? I mean, my wife and I have 4 doctorates between us. We were educated at some of the highest level Ivy League schools in this country, right? And here are these folks thinking that I've gone off the deep end, and therefore I might pose a security threat to them. So what they did was they sent us a letter that basically said that there's going to be a security detail coming after me. Now, this is after Dr. Mike Davidson at the Brigham had been murdered by a psychopath who, you know, had some psychological problems. And so they were using that as an excuse because they're on high alert. Now, meanwhile, Dr. Davidson was actually one of my own attendings when I was training. And, you know, his death was an extremely sad thing for me. So here's the hospital, sure, all revved up. So instead of going around and talking to our friend and talking to us, they send us this letter at a time when, you know, the reason why we went back up to the Brigham was not to make a show of force or anything. One of the best thoracic surgeons in the country, you know, was one of my teachers, Dr. Scott Swanson, and he practices at the Brigham. So I would not have had anyone else but Dr. Swanson operating on my wife in the location, right, that she was having that operation. So we go up there, they send us this letter, and, you know, it was clearly an act of intimidation. You know, either that or it was this thoughtless act of being defensive. So in either way, it translated into them bullying me around, you know, and I think it was an atrocious thing. I mean, it's not worthy of leadership, you know, and I think the people who made that decision should basically all just step down because they were frankly in violation of my First Amendment rights, and that's what a judge decided when we took it. And it was, you know, Evelyn, it was absolutely historic. Many lawyers in the city of Boston, you know, are stating that it's extremely rare for there to be a temporary restraining order given to a patient against the hospital's corporate wing. You know, I mean, just think about it.
You know what I do?
That's what happens.
Excuse me, you know what I do? I always run out of time, and we're running close. So I don't know if people understood that they actually did search you and everything.
And they did. They searched us when we came in the hospital. I have to tell you, I was really upset by this letter because Suman was the only person traveling with me, and they said they reminded him that if he didn't comply with the rules that they put out, that they would remove him from the premises. So here
And you would have been there alone.
I would have been there alone. I'm faced with them forcibly removing my healthcare proxy for rules that only apply to him. So we had been there half a dozen, 10 times in the past 3 years. What changed? Other than someone said, hey, I have a good idea. Let's see if this will keep them down. You know, let's see if this will shut them up. I mean, it was awful. We're patients at this hospital. We brought up a patient safety event, and now we're more or less being penalized for it. I mean, it's
during your treatment. Oh, yes.
Yes.
Listen,
yeah. And
I'm
we had
have
choice,
to wrap this.
You know, we had seen
other surgeons. I know you had to do it. Yeah, and then you
awful.
Went to court, but it was after it happened, you know, and so they got the temporary restraining order.
No,
but you
I
were
was
not
in the
a
hospital.
Threat to them.
Suman spent the majority of the time while I was recovering in the hospital, the day of my surgery and after my surgery, on the phone with our lawyer, discussing how we could get the security guard removed from my hospital room.
Okay, there's my song telling me it's ending. Listen, can I have you back in a couple weeks?
Absolutely,
we'd be happy to, and thanks for having us, Evelyn.
Okay,
thank you so much.
In 2 weeks, okay? Okay, thank you so much for coming on. Okay, bye. Well, thank you, everybody, for tuning in. This was a great show, and I want you to learn more about this how when you go up against the medical establishment. So, okay, goodbye.